jump in.
We started Perek Chof Aleph last week. That's where we are at. So we're going to reread the Perek. Kind of delved, started it a little bit, touched on one particular aspect of it, which linked to our previous Perek. But today I really want to start this Perek.
352.
Excellent. Janet coming?
I don't know.
Okay.
And she's not here yet. I know Sunny's coming.
She
didn't come last time.
Last week her help didn't come on time.
Right. Okay. Yeah, okay. Perek Chav Aleph is where we're up to. Vayakom Vayelach Yonatan Bahair. We read this parak last week. We're rereading it, and today we're going to go it a little slower and go into some detail. Vayakom Vayelach Yonatan Bahair. He got up, he left. Yonatan came and went to the city. Vayakom Vayelach, referring to David, mentioned last week that there's a certain ambiguity in the beginning of this parak. We don't know where is David going? Vayakom Vayelach Yonatan Bahair. Yonatan has a destination. Where is David going? Doesn't say. It will tell us in the next pasuk. Vayavod David Nove. And he comes to the city of Nov. But it doesn't say that he went to the city of Nov. It says that he got up and he left. And Yonatan went back to the city of the Melech. And you get that sense that David is sort of left in the field, alone, confused. This is going to be the start of probably the darkest, lowest chapter in or part of David's life. And here he's sort of, after everything is said and done, and Yonatan goes back to his father, and Yaakov, Ayelach, and he runs, and he knows he has to run, and he has no place safe for him, and he's standing there, and you don't know where he's going to go. And then Ve'avod David Nove comes to the city of Nov. What is the city of Nov? City of Nov, El Achimelech HaKohen, to the priest Achimelech. We'll talk about Achimelech in a minute. Ve'echarad Achimelech Ukrat David Ve'yomer lo madu ata levadecha ve'ishen itach. Achimelech comes running after him. He says to him, well, why are you here? Why are you alone? ויאמר דוד לאחימלך הכהן, המלך ציווני דבר ויאמר אלי איש על ידע מאומת, הדבר אשר נוכי שלחך ואשר ציוויתיך, ואת הנערים ידעתי אל מקום פלוני אלמוני. In order to hide his true intention, he doesn't want to tell him that he's running from the king, he makes up a story. And he says, I'm on a king's mission, I'm on a secret mission. The king sent me on a very secret mission, nobody's allowed to know, not even the nearim. I'm here by myself. But ואתה מה יש תחת ידך חמישה לחם תנה בידי או הנמצא. Now give me food. Now I'm starving. So we talked about the fact that he's so hungry last week, the fact that he hasn't eaten for 3 days, and why he hasn't eaten for 3 days. But ultimately he comes and he eats, and the king gives him the food from the lechem hapanim of the Beit HaMikdash. ויען הכהן את דוד ויאמר אין לחם מחול תחת ידי. I have no unconsecrated bread. I have no ordinary bread. כי אם לחם קודש יש. The only thing I have is לחם קודש, is the bread from the temple. אם נשמרו הנערים אך מאישה. But you can only eat the לחם קודש if you are not tamei, if you have made sure that you haven't been in contact with a woman in terms of tumat keri. And another tumult. Vayan David et haKohen, vayomer lo, ki misha tzuva lanu ketmol shishom betziti v'yukol klei na'arim kodesh, v'hu derachol ve'af ki hayom mikdash bakeli. So that pasuk we talked about last week, it's somewhat of an ambiguous and unintelligible sentence, grammatically, but the gist of it is that we are on a mission several days. We have not had any contact with our wives. The Na'arim are observing all of their food eating all of their food in a state of purity. Vayten lo kohen kodesh ki lo haya sham lechem ki im lechem hapanim amusarim lifnei Hashem lasum lechem chom biyom hilakcho. So he gave him the lechem apanim. He gave him the bread of the Beit HaMikdash, because there's nothing else there to eat except for the lechem apanim, the showbread of the Beit HaMikdash. I'm going to stop here for a moment. That's sort of the end of part one of the story. I'm going to come back to the. So why Nov? I asked the question earlier. Why Nov? What is Nov? Where is Nov? What's going on? So what do we know about Nov? Often referred to as Nov Ir HaKohanim.
Where was it?
So, a little bit of the map is helpful. Nov is the location where the Mishkan is moved to after the fall of Shiloh. Mm-hmm. If we go back to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, where Shiloh is destroyed, the Mishkan is destroyed in chapter...
Oh, be careful, Rabbi.
Okay. Made out of cardboard. where the Mishkan is destroyed in chapter 4. The Mishkan is up here in Shiloh. And Shaul himself, Melech, we don't necessarily have a place with a capital city for the kingdom of Israel during the time of Shaul, but most likely that he's in an area referred to often as Givat Shaul. Not so far from Givat Shaul of today, north of Yerushalayim. And Nov is on, it's not clear where Nov is, the various theories to where Nov is, but it's most likely in the northern ridge of modern-day Yerushalayim. Some suggest if you've ever been to a place called Nevi Samuel, there's a hill north of Yerushalayim where they have a monument that the Arabs have a tradition is the Kefer of Shmuel and Navi. So they call it Nevi Samuel, Nevi Samuel. So there's a theory that Nebi is actually, it's a mistranslation. Nebi Samuel was actually from the ancient city of Nov. So I heard that theory. It's probably correct. Neither does it may, we're in this area here. And why it will become important is because David, at the end of this chapter, is going to run to Gat, which is not so far. And then he's going to run to Mar. So we're sort of in this region here, which is the border between Binyamin and Yehuda.
And you said last week that he hadn't eaten for 3 days because there was no food available? Or?
No, I suggested last week he hadn't eaten for 3 days because he was in hiding with the story of Yonatan. And then that was the answer to the question of why we went from 1 day Rosh Chodesh to 2 days Rosh Chodesh. Why that was so significant, because it meant that he was hiding for an extra day without food. And that was unanticipated. And then he ends up running... And Yonatan doesn't give him any food because he hadn't anticipated that there was going to be this delay. And so by the time David runs, he's been hiding for 3 days. And how long it takes him to get to Nov, trying to escape the king's officers, etc. It's unclear, but clearly he's been hiding, he's been running, and he's not in a place of... He's not in a good place. So he's hungry, he's starving, he's so desperate that he's willing to eat the lechem hapanim, which is strictly for kohanim, is reserved for kohanim, not allowed to eat the lechem hapanim unless you're a kohen. We'll talk about that conversation with Achim Melech in a moment. But that was sort of... And where we had connected it last week was to the Medrash, to Gemara, that's actually a frightening Gemara, that suggests that the blame for all of this lies on the shoulders of Yonatan. Gemara says, had Yonatan given David 2 loaves of bread, we would have spared the city of Kohanim from its destruction. Because in the end, David's presence in Nov, and we know the story as it progresses, David's presence in Nov, and Achimelech's assistance to him comes back to Shaul. Shaul takes out his anger on the city of Nov, destroys the Mishkan, and slaughters every one of the members of the city, including the women and children. It's a bloodbath. So the fall of Nov, the destruction of Nov, ultimately comes back to why does David run to Nov? And the possibility that David in some way is accountable for that event. David himself, in the next chapter, will blame himself for the fall of Nov. Right? Once he hears about the destruction of Nov, David will blame himself for it because of his encounter with Achimelech. Whether that's true or not is... lots of reasons, lots of places to put the blame, but nonetheless, it's a tragic period of history. We're dealing with the lowest point in David's life. There's a series of events that are going to take place, one tragedy after another.
Does Hashem ever blame him for it in any way?
We'll get there. We'll get there. We shall get there. So I come back to the question. Here's the Mishkan. Remember that the Mishkan at this point, and for the most part for all of Sefer Shmuel, is split. Why is the Mishkan split? What do I mean by the Mishkan is split?
It's in two different places.
It's in two parts. What are the two parts? We talked about this. I won't expect you to remember, but we talked about this when we first started Sefer Shmuel. Why is the Mishkan split?
Such a good excuse. Janet's not here, so I should remember.
Me now.
Essentially, the Mishkan is comprised of two elements. One is the Aron that lives inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the other is everything else. Because everything else is replaceable. Everything else is replaceable. The Mizbeach can be replaced, can be rebuilt. The Shulchan can be rebuilt. The Menorah can be rebuilt. The one thing that's not replaceable is the Aron. When the Aron gets captured by the Plishtim in the story of the Battle of the Plishtim in Perek Dalet, the city of Shiloh and the Mishkan in Shiloh is destroyed. The Aron itself eventually comes back, but it goes into hiding. They put it after the tragedy in Beit Shemesh. They sent it to a place called Kiryat Yarim, and it's there in Kiryat Yarim for safekeeping until David will call for it after he rebuilds Yerushalayim Sefer Shmuel Bet. When David tries to build a capital and a temple, etc., he'll call for the Aron. Until such time, the Aron is separated from the rest of the Mishkan. So pretty much all of Sefer Shmuel, the Aron and the Mizbeach don't come back together until the Beit HaMikdash is built, and that's built by Shlomo at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Malachim. That's built by Shlomo at the beginning of Sefer Malachim. So for all of Sefer Shmuel, the Aron and the Mizbeach are separated.
Is anybody worried about that?
No, but it's actually defines the character of Sefer Shmuel. We actually used that theory to explain why Sefer Shmuel is an independent book. Why it's not part of Sefer Shoftim and not part of Sefer Malachim. Because the books of Tanakh follow the state of the Shechina, not the state of the kingdom. And so when the Mishkan is operational at Sefer Shoftim, Mishkan is separated as Sefer Shmuel, the Mikdash is standing is Sefer Malachim. So the books of Tanakh are defined by the status of the Mishkan and the status of the Shechina, not by the status of the political leadership at the time.
That's quite interesting.
Right. That was sort of how we got into the conversation. Why is Sefer Shmuel an independent Sefer? Half of it deals with the aftermath of the end of Sefer Shoftim, and the other half deals with the beginning of Sefer Malachim. Why is it an independent book? And we suggested, it's a theory by Rav Medan, that it's based on the trajectory of the Mishkan. So the fact that the Mishkan is separated is not an accident. It's a central motif to the Sefer. The Aron is in Kiryat Yarim. Nov is the city of the Mishkan. So when it falls in Shiloh, the Mizbeach gets moved to Nov, somewhere here north of Yerushalayim, still stays in the area of Shevet Binyamin. Actually, Shiloh was in Shevet Ephraim, but this is Shevet Binyamin. Is pretty much where it belongs, and so David, when he runs to this Nov, runs straight to the Mishkan. Why? Well, it comes back to the question: why does David run to the Mishkan?
Is it important how many years we're all talking about between this Malachim and Sefer Shmuel and this whole thing?
Well, we don't know how long Sefer Shmuel is in total. We know parts of it. David himself reigns post Shmuel for 40 years. But how long Shaul, post Shaul, how long Shaul reigns for is one of the mysteries of the Sefer. So even if it's assumed for a moment 20 years, so 60 or 70 years, we're not talking
centuries.
No, we're not talking centuries at all. Essentially, the entire book of Shmuel covers the story of two leaders, Shaul and David. More or less Shaul and Shmuel Aleph and David and Shmuel Bet. So. Okay, come back to my question. Why Nov? Why does he run to the Mishkan?
If he feels safer there.
So, could be that he feels safer there.
Hasn't he always had that pattern to run to where Hashem is?
So good. you know, picking up the thought process of Sefer Shmuel. So when he ran the first time, back in a couple of chapters ago, when he ran from the palace, Michal let him out the window. Mm-hmm. Where did he run to?
He ran to a field.
To the prophet?
He ran to Shmuel. Okay, he ran to Shmuel. And he spent some time with Shmuel. Now, the second time he runs to the Mishkan. I don't think that's an accident. I think that there is a certain trajectory in David's mind as he runs. The first step, the first stop along the way, is a kind of infusion of spirituality, if you will. He runs to the Navi or he runs to the Mishkan, either way. To consult with, he can't consult with the, he certainly can't go back to Shmuel at this point. That road has been closed off. He's not going to stay in Nov, but being in Nov gives him the opportunity to engage with the Kohen and, number one, get food. Right, number one, get food. Number two, to consult. How would you consult with the Kohen? What's the mechanism to consult with God through by running to the Mishkan?
The breastplate?
Yeah, you consult with the Kohen through the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, etc. And in fact, while it doesn't tell us here that he consulted in that way, it does in the next chapter. If you jump ahead one chapter, when David is informed upon to Shaul, and he's told that that David came to Nov, it says, take a look in Pasuk Tet. Perchaper Pasuk Tet. Vayan Doeg Adomi. We're going to talk about this Doeg Adomi in a few moments. This Doeg Adomi had been there in Nov. He's one of the officers of the king. And he says, Ra'iti et Ben Yishai ba Nov. I saw Ben Yishai come to the city of Nov. El Achimelech Ben Achituv. To this Kohen by the name of Achimelech ben Achituv. What did he do when he got there? Vayishal lo ba'Hashem. He sought God's guidance. He asked of God, meaning through the Urim V'Tumim. And v'tzeda natan lo. And he gave him food. Ve'et cherev Goliath ha'plishti natan lo. And he gave him Goliath's sword, which also part of the conversation in Perek, in our Perek. So this Doeg is watching this whole story. He's the one who's going to inform on David, is going to tell Shaul what happened. But included in his report is not only that he gave him food and that he gave him Goliath's sword, both of which are stories that are written explicitly in the chapter. We saw that. But there's one more piece in his report, which is Vayishalo Bahashem, that he sought God's guidance, advice, that he engaged the Kohen in that conversation. So even though it's not on the text, it is referred to later on. We have a good sense that that's part of what he goes to Nov to do, to kind of, okay, he's starting his journey. Where do I go? What do I do? I seek the guidance of the Urim V'Tumim. David as a leader, David as a king, David as a warrior, will engage in the question, in the process of seeking the Kohen's, seeking God's counsel through the Kohen's Urim V'Tumim, will do so more than any other personality in all of Tanakh. Almost every battle that David engages in, we will read, we will see in the text, he turns to the Kohen and he asks him through the Urim V'Tumim, well, should I, shouldn't I, what should I do, etc. It's a theme in David's life, is the constant consultation with God through the Urim V'Tumim. Contrast that with Shaul,
who doesn't care,
right? Who doesn't seek the guidance of the Urim V'Tumim, who in fact one time had almost sought the Urim V'Tumim's guidance in the battle, and at that moment he changed his mind. He said, no, I don't have time to wait. Remember, that was the Battle of Michmas, where he said, I don't have time to wait for the Urim V'Tumim to respond, I'm going, right? So the one time that he consults with the Urim V'Tumim, he insults it. Contrast Shaul to David, who from his very first steps as he leaves the palace of Shaul, his very first steps are to go to the Mishkan and to consult with the Urim V'Tumim. And that's really remarkable. One additional possibility as to why he runs to Nov, although he doesn't stay in Nov, but there is one more possibility, and that is that there is a role for the Mishkan beyond, or the Mizbeach, beyond just the Lechem upon him and the offerings of the Korbanot and the Urim V'Tumim. So one more role of the Mizbeach, and that's that Nov was an Ir Miklat. It's one of the cities of refuge, one of the places where Otzech B'Shogeg, for example, would run to. Mm-hmm. And the Arei Miklat were typically Arei Levim, they were typically the Levitical cities or Kohanim cities. They were typically, and the Mizbech had a unique role in that. Somebody who's found guilty of a capital crime, the Torah says has to be, you can take him to be punished even from off the Mizbech. Why do I have to say that why does the Torah have to say if the Beit Din has found him guilty, then he can be taken even from the Mizbeach? Because it was not uncommon to run to the Mizbeach as a kind of a refuge. Grab hold, we'll see by Shlomo, there's a famous story in Sefer Melachim, where Adoniyahu is accused of treason, and he runs to the Mishkan to grab hold of the Mizbeach as a kind of there's sanctuary. There's a term for it, and I'm just escaping me for a moment. Historically, it's been very common for places of worship and religious institutions to become a safe haven, independent from sanctuary, from persecution or from the authority, or from. So, in a certain sense, David runs to the Mishkan as a kind of an escape, right? Hoping that the Mishkan itself, the experience of the Mishkan, the Mizbeach, and the Kohanim could provide him
with safety.
With safety. He could hide there. And maybe that was his intention. Maybe his intention was to go to the Mishkan in order to hide, in order to stay, right? Get food. Let him hide him in the sanctuary, at least until he can regroup himself and find out where he's going to go and what he's going to do. The next stage, the next place he's going to run to is an act of total desperation, and that's to run to Eretz Plishtim. Can't believe that that's a rational decision. David's intention when he left Yonatan was not to run to Eretz Plishtim. His intention was to run to Nov, to run to the sanctuary, to run to the Mizbeach, and there hopefully to stay, I would suspect. Why doesn't he stay? So look at the next verse. So he gets the bread from Achimelech. Pasuk Zayin, Veiten lo kohen kodesh, ki lo haya sham lechem, ki im lechem apanim amusum lifnei Hashem, lasum lechem chom biyom ilakcho. Gets the showbread. Next pasuk Chet. Vesham ish meavdei Shaul bayomahu neetzar lifnei Hashem ushmo doega adomi abir haroim asher leShaul. Who is in Nov? None other than doega adomi, one of the king's shepherds, one of the king's officers, one of the king's men, one of the people loyal to the king. Happened to be there, ne'etzar lifnei Hashem, happened to be caught there, meaning he had come to bring offerings, and it's Shabbos, don't forget, so he was stuck there for Shabbos. So he happens to be there amongst the parishioners in the Shabbos morning davening. I can't believe that David would not see him and recognize him. And the fact that we're told at this moment in the story that Doeg Adami is there, and at that point the next pasuk is Vayomer David laAchimelech. David continues the conversation and he says to Achimelech, "Do you have a sword? Do you have a spear? Do you have some kind of weapon? Because I have no weapon." I don't think that's an accident.
Because he knows who he is.
Right? Because he knows who he is. So I suspect in part that David's decision to leave the sanctuary of the Mizbeach is a recognition that even in Nov, even in the Mizbeach, even in the sanctuary of the Kohanim, he is not safe. And clearly we know that he's not safe because Doeg Adami is the one who ultimately he informs on him. So David's the moment he recognizes Doeg, he realizes he has to get out. But it's his first stop. Who is Achimelech? What do we know about Achimelech? You know anything about Achimelech?
We must know something.
Why must we know something?
That's about it.
I don't know.
We must know something. I suspect the reason you said we must know something is because I probably wouldn't have asked the question if we didn't know anything.
Exactly.
Right. So what do we know? So far, what do we know?
He's a
Kohen. Achimelech. We also know his full name.
Yeah,
I just read it.
No, he's Ben somebody.
Right. Achimelech Ben. I just read it. We actually read it in Perakot Bet.
Yeah. It's in here somewhere.
Achimelech Ben Achitov. Now, let's just for a moment stop for a second and look at names. Very interesting names. Achimelech Ben Achitov. There's a certain structure to biblical names. They're Hebrew and they're easily broken up. Okay, so in both Achimelech and Achitov, you have the name
Achi.
Achi Melech and Achi
Tov.
Not an uncommon Achimelech, Achia, Achitov. These are words that you put together the same way we Adoniyahu, Yoshiyahu, Matanya, Yedidya. We take names and combine them and you get significant and meaningful combinations. Achimelech ben Achitov, Achitov. Why is that significant? Because Achimelech ben Achitov may be somebody we know about from before. Maybe. I say maybe because it's not quite clear, but Achitov should ring a bell. No?
No bell ringing.
No bell ringing. All right. Let's go back to Perek Yudalad. Perek Yudalad is that story where Shaul insults the Urim Betumim. We just talked about it a moment ago. Battle of Michmas, where Shaul insults the Urim Betumim. How does he insult the Urim Betumim?
He doesn't want to wait for the answer.
Doesn't want to wait for the answer.
Oh, I see the name here.
Okay.
Gimel, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
Achiyah ben Achitov.
Achiyah ben Achitov, Achi Ikavod ben Pinchas ben Eli Kohen Hashem Bishilo Nose Ephod. It's the famous story of Barah Michmas. Shaul, Yonatan goes off to fight first. Shaul is standing there waiting. And remember, he doesn't want to wait for Shaul, for Shmuel, and he's told him to wait for 7 days, and he doesn't. Right? Famous story. Okay. Achiyah ben Achitov, Achi Ikavod ben Pinchas ben Eli Kohen Hashem Bishilo Nose Ephod. Who is carrying the Ephod? Who is the Kohen Gadol? Achiyah ben Achitov. Achi Ikavod ben Pinchas ben Eli HaKohen Hashem Mishilo. So, what do we know about Achimelech ben Achitov?
He's got Yichus.
Achimelech ben Achitov is the brother, well, it's unclear. Achi, who is somebody's brother here? Achimelech ben Achitov, first of all, it says Achiyah ben Achitov. Is Achiyah ben Achitov the same as Achimelech ben Achitov? Possibly.
Well, couldn't they just be brothers?
They could be brothers, right? But it's also quite possible that Achiyah and Achimelech is the same name. Why is it possible that they're the same name?
It's got all the same letters.
Well, besides no, that, well, this is certainly the same name.
That's the same. But
Achiyah and Achimelech could be the same name. Why? Because, break it down, Achimelech and Achiyah. Achiyah is referring to God. What is God?
King.
King. So it's quite possible that they are in fact the same name. Possible that they're different names, brothers of brothers of each other. So it's either Achitov, who has Achiyah and Achimelech, but given the fact that they're Kohen, he's the Kohen in Perek Yedalad, and he's the Kohen in Perek Kohen Gadol. He's the Kohen Gadol in Perek Yedalad, and he's the Kohen Gadol in Perek Chabet, and we're talking about the same period of history. Unlikely that these are two different people. It's much more likely, logical, and compelling to suggest that they are in fact the same person. So we're going to work with that theory.
Maybe they were twins.
Yeah, but given the fact that they're both the Kohen Gadol at five chapters apart on the same period of time, it's less likely. It's more likely that they are in fact the same individual.
So these people are all Kohen Gadols, right?
The that's reference here is to the Kohen Gadol. The Ephod is the Kohen Gadol. We're not finished. We're not finished with the Yichus. Achimelech ben Achituv. What else do we know about the Yichus? Achi.
Ikavod.
Achi Ikavod. Now here, this machlokas mafreshim, which we have no way of knowing the resolution to, which is who is Ikavod's brother? Is it Achimelech ben Achituv? Achi Ikavod, or is it Achimelech ben Achituv? Achi Ikavod. Working off the assumption.
With all these names, you need to dissect this a little bit more.
Yeah. Working off the assumption, Achimelech ben Achituv is the brother of Ikavod. Who's the brother of Ikavod? Achimelech or Achituv? If Achimelech ben Achituv is Achi Ikavod, it's a little odd, right? So I'm going to work up the assumption that they are, in fact, brothers, Achituv and Ikavod. Who is Ikavod? The English name of Ikavod is, of course, Ikabod. That's a separate issue. Right? Achimelech ben Achituv, Achi Ikavod, ben
Eli HaKohen.
Then
Pinchas.
Then Eli. So here is your Yichus. Eli, Pinchas, Achituv and Akavod were brothers. Achimelech ben Achituv, Achi Ikavod ben Pinchas. Ikavod is the brother, is the son who is born as Pinchas dies. Right? So either they're half brothers and he's born later, or it's more likely he's the older brother. Right? At the fall of Shiloh, Pinchas goes into battle with the Aron. The Aron is taken captive. Pinchas dies in battle. His wife is pregnant. His wife gives birth at the time that Pinchas is dying, and she calls him Ikavod because the Kavod, the Shtina, was taken captive. Ikavod, Ein Kavod, Ein Shchina. The Aron is taken captive. That's the naming of Ikavod. His whole identity is tied up in the fall of Shiloh and the destruction of the Mishkan, and the destruction of the curse of the house of Eli. Mm-hmm. So interestingly enough, Eli is the Kohen HaGadol in Shiloh. When Shiloh falls, so is Pinchas, right? He was in Shiloh. When Shiloh falls, the Mishkan moves to Nov. And who is the Kohen in Nov? Achimelech ben Achituv, Achi Ikavod, ben Pinchas, ben Eli. Eli's grandson, great grandson.
Okay.
Remnant of the house of Eli. Remnant of the house of Eli. So one more name out there. Eventually, Shiloh is going to fall. Shaul is going to kill everybody in Shiloh. And one survivor is going to make his way to David's side and will remain with David for the rest of the story of David's battle.
Is it Shiloh or Nov?
Sorry, after the fall of Nov.
Okay.
Shiloh?
Yeah, Shiloh.
After the, when Shaul comes and destroys Nov,
okay.
Kills all the Kohanim, kills Achimelech, kills everybody, his whole family, there's one survivor, and his name is Eviatar. Eviatar is the son of Achimelech, and Eviatar will survive and eventually go and run to David.
So then he's the Kohen Gadol.
He will be the Kohen who will travel with David in all of his journey.
But he's the Kohen Gadol, wouldn't
it? It's hard to define him as a Kohen Gadol because he's not with him. He'll carry the ephod, but remember, David is on the run. David is not, doesn't have a Mishkan. He's not on the. He's on the run. But this Eviatar is a remnant, a survivor of the destruction of Nev. Where the Mishkan goes, we'll talk about. The Mishkan will go from here to Kibbutz. That's the story of Achimelech. So Achimelech, interestingly enough, is a remnant of the house of Eli. And suddenly our story is coming full circle because it's bringing us back to Nov, the replacement of Shiloh, and the remnant of the destruction of the Mishkan. Suddenly we're reminded of all of those pieces that we talked about way back in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel about the fall of the Mishkan and Eli's corruption and Pinchas' corruption and the corruption in the Mishkan and the corruption in the values of the Mishkan, etc. That all led to the fall of Shiloh, and we're about to find ourselves facing the destruction of Nov. Because when Shaul comes in to kill all the Kohanim, kills everything, destroys the Mishkan. This is a Churban. This is no less than the Churban of the Mishkan, no less than the Churban of the Beit HaMikdash. Shaul is going to kill all the Kohanim and destroy the Mishkan in his wrath.
Does Shaul have any regrets of what he's doing here?
At this point in time, we don't know of any. At this point, Shaul is past.
Past the point of no return.
Right. Now, having suggested that, in fact, Achimelech is a remnant of the house of Eli, also gives us some insight into the conversation between David and Achimelech. I think somebody picked this up last week, mentioned it briefly, and I kind of said, okay, we'll come back to that. Let's go back to the conversation between David and Achimelech. Specifically about the bread. And so David arrives desperate and hungry. Back to Parakabalah. David arrives desperate and hungry. Achimelech says to him, "Why are you alone?" He makes up a story. And then David says, I need bread, I need food. What do you have? He says, I have five loaves of bread. Okay, I'll take them, whatever you've got. I don't have any non-consecrated bread. All I have is lechem kodesh.
How come?
Because the Kohanim, it's a city of Kohanim. So the Kohanim eat on Shabbos, the Kohanim eat the lechem aponim. That's what they eat. They eat the shobah. That's their bread for Shabbos. So they're not going to break. They have to finish the lechem aponim by nightfall. They have to finish it by Motzei Shabbat. It can only be eaten on Shabbat and that night. It's Kodesh HaKadoshim. So they're not going to break their own bread because they need to eat the lechem aponim. They need to finish it. So David happened to arrive on Shabbos. That we talked about last week. And he arrives on Shabbos. He arrives desperate from hunger. But the only food the Kohanim have are the food of Lechem Aponim. We also suggest that there's an entire city of Nov, but David doesn't go into the city. Unlikely that he wants to be seen, right? Doesn't want to be seen, doesn't want to be public, he's on the run. So he comes to the Kohen Gadol inside the Beis HaMikdash, or the Mishkan, and then he says, what do you have? He says, we're in the Mishkan here. We've got Kohanim and Mishmar. All we have is the Lechem Aponim. David says, I'll take it. He's dying of hunger. To which the Kohen responds and he says, Ki im lechem kodesh, im nishmeru anari machmeisha. But you can't eat the lechem akvanim if you are tame. Tumat keri, tuma that's created by relations between man and wife, can't have tumat keri, can't have it. So I can give you the lechem akvanim. David says, I'm dying of hunger here. He says, that's fine. I'm happy to give you the lechem akvanim, but you have to be taught. Remember, lechem akvanim is strictly to be eaten by kohanim. It's kodesh hakodashim. The fact that it had to be eaten in a state of tumah is, in a certain sense, far less significant than the fact that it was the food of the kohen. So if it's if you can provide it to a non-kohen, the only reason, the only basis or justification for providing it to a non-kohen would be pikuach nefesh. If it's pikuach nefesh, why does it have to be tar? If it's pikuach nefesh, why does he bother with a conversation about whether or not David is tahor and his na'arim atal na'anim aren't even there? It's like, what's the... And it's three psukim. They're observing everything in a state of sanctity because they're on the run. Even non-consecrated bread they eat in a state of tara, and certainly today, because that's all there. It's like his whole focus on the fact that it was given to him, but only in the condition that it was in a state of tara, a state of purity, etc. I don't know. There's something about this conversation that bothers me, because one of two things: either David is really in a state of pikuach nefesh, in which case this conversation should not have started, or he's not in a state of pikuach nefesh, in which case he really should be eating the lechem apanim altogether. Assuming a former, why is Achimelech spend so much time engaging with David in a conversation? The man has clearly stated, I'm dying of hunger, he hasn't eaten in 4 days, he's clearly in rags and ruin, and you're going to bother with a conversation, a negotiation about whether or not he's tamei or tahor, whether or not there have been women in the camp? It's like, where are the priorities?
How many people were with him that he would be worried about whether he's tahor or tamei? Wasn't he?
It's Achimelech and David. It's a private conversation with Achimelech and David. Well, no, because remember, David, he tells Achimelech that he has Na'arim, he just sent them on ahead, right?
But they weren't.
So they're not there.
So he's the only person there.
It's a very strange conversation. And the only explanation that I can really give to this conversation is that Achimelech is a great grandson of Eli. If Eli was having this conversation, or Pinchas was having this conversation, we would say,
that's them.
That makes sense, right? That's Eli. That's Pinchas. Cares more about the sanctity and the purity and the process of Kahuna than he cares about the people. If it was Eli, if it was Pinchas, I'd get it. It's not. It's Achimelech. But it's Achimelech, Menachitov, Achi, Yikavod, Ben Pinchas, Ben Eli, Akohen, Hashem, Beshilo. And suddenly we're back to Shiloh and Eli and the remnant of the house of Eli, and one chapter later the entire Mishkan is going to be destroyed lock, stock and barrel, the same way Eli's Mishkan was destroyed lock, stock and barrel. Maybe just part of the trajectory of the story.
He has the same attributes and the same genes went way back.
These things aren't accidental.
The apple doesn't fall.
Right? These things are not accidental. There's trajectories here that are significant, and I think they need to be identified. Okay. The truth is, we can go one step further, because it's interesting to note that David begins. This is really the beginning of David's ascent to the throne. Up until this point in the story, David has been essentially serving Shaul. The beginning of David's first steps as an independent leader comes in this chapter. Because he runs to Nov, then he runs to Gath, then he runs to Moab, and then beginning of Perek Chav Bet, he begins to put together his own group, his own followers, his own band, his gedud, 400 people who will follow him into battle, will follow him, right? This is where David's beginning of his building his own following and his own independent process up to, which will eventually lead to the army of David and his ascent to the throne. This departure from Shaul allows David to begin to, he'll hit rock bottom, but he'll begin to build from there up to his ascent to the throne. This is the beginning of the first steps in that process. So it's interesting to compare the sequence of events in the beginning of David's ascent to the throne to the sequence of events in the beginning of Shaul's ascent to the throne. So compare Shaul as he started, first steps, literally baby steps, where Shaul was to where David is. And it's an interesting contrast, because Shaul, when he first encounters the fact that he's going to be king, where is he?
Hiding.
Well, that's a sort of a second step, but when he first encounters that he's going to be king, it's in a conversation with Shmuel. It's a conversation with Shmuel. He has this whole encounter with Shmuel. He has a whole chapter back in. Anybody remember a chapter?
That's asking a lot.
9 and 10. So let's take a look at 9. Sorry. Do that again. Let's take a look at 10. וכך שמואל את פח השמן ויצוק על ראשו וישקהו. שמואל took a flask of oil, poured it over Shaul's head, kissed him. This is after they spent all night talking on the rooftop. ויאמר, הלא כי משכחה השם על נחלתו לנגיד. God has anointed you over his inheritance, over his portion, over his people as their leader. Then he gives him 3 signs. Remember the signs? Right. Gives him 3 indicators that, in fact, this message is coming from God. The first, "Belechtecha yom imadi umatzata shnei anashim im kvurat Rachel begvur binyamin betzatzach v'yomru elecha nimtzu atonot shalachta levakesh v'inei natasha v'icha tivrei atonot v'da'ag lachem lemor ma e'ese livni." First sign is that you're going to encounter 2 people coming from Kever Rachel. Discussion about the location of Kever Rachel, if you remember, we had a digression about where Kever Rachel is. And they're going to tell you that those donkeys that you were looking, that your father was had sent you looking for, they were found, and your father's no longer worried about the donkeys, he's worried about you. Okay? And that's part of the conversation. What happens next? V'chalafta misham. I'm in Perek Yud Pasuk Gimel. Chalafta misham. You're going to continue your journey. Uvata ad Elon Tavor, umetzacha sham shlosha anashim olim el Elokim bet El. Going to encounter 3 people headed to the temple in Beit El. Beit El is not the city of Beit El, it's the house of God, meaning the Mishkan, which is most likely in Shiloh. Echad nosei shlosha gdeim. One is going to be carrying goats for the offering. Echad nosei shloshet kikot lachem. The other is going to be carrying 3 loaves of bread. And the other is going to be carrying the wine for the libation. Sha'alu lecha l'shalom. They're going to ask you, they're going to say shalom aleichem. V'natnu lecha shtei lechem. They're going to give you 2 of these loaves of bread. V'lakachta mihadam. You're going to take it from them. And then you'll go on, and the next story will be the story of the Nevi'im, which is not our issue for now. It's fascinating that Shaul's ascent to the throne starts with an encounter with 2 people headed to the Mishkan who are going to offer Shaul what?
Bread
from the offering. Bread that is Kodesh. Bread that is given to the Mizbeach. And here's David on the run. First step of his ascent to the throne is a stop off in the Mishkan. Not intentional. And circumstances are such that he ends up taking bread from the Mishkan, bread from the Mizbeach, bread from the Shulchan. Lechem Kodesh. So both Shaul and David, whose story of Malchus begins at this moment, begin completely different circumstances. But they begin their journey with an engagement, with the moment where they have to eat of the bread of the Mizbeach. Shaul's case, by mandate of the Navi. In David's case, by desperation, because he's running from Shaul. Yeah. Circumstances at the opposite ends of the spectrum. But it's fascinating that they both start with the mandate to eat of the bread of the Mizbeach. That can't be an accident. That can't be an accident. So what's the significance of the fact that the Melech, in his ascent, is eating the bread of the Mizbeach? Now let's put it into a philosophical frame of reference. What's the significance? Why does that matter? What's the symbolism of it?
Maybe that's why he's asking him all these questions, because he wants to make sure that he's going to be okay to be the king. Double-checking him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know if he thinks, if Achimelech is thinking in those terms, because that would be somewhat treasonous for Achimelech to be thinking about David becoming king. I mean, nobody knows. That would be treasonous, technically. But and I don't think any of this is conscious in terms of David's sense that, okay, Shaul ate bread from the Mizbeach. When he became king, I'm going to eat bread from the Bechana, right? None of this is happening on the level of the awareness of the players involved. This is much more beneath the surface. But I think that there is a significance to the fact that the Melech, in his ascent to the throne, first step, a long journey ahead, but the first step is the message that he's eating the Mizbeach, the Lechem of the Mizbeach. Why?
A spiritual connection there?
Maybe a spiritual connection. Maybe a connection to the Mishkan. Or connection to the Mizbeach. Let's build that for a moment. What is the role of a Melech? What is the job description of a Melech? What's the mandate of a Melech?
He has to take care of everything.
He has to take care of everything. So taking care of everything divides up into two parts. Mm-hmm. He has to provide for the security from enemies, from without. And he has to essentially provide, what is the role of any government? Right? To provide security and to provide
welfare.
And right? To provide for the well-being of the people. In the language of Malchus, the people are somech al shulchano. The people eat of the food of the king. The king defines, okay. Like in any government, why does the government of any country drive the economy of the country? Because it's government policies that set that impact the economy structure, taxes, and what have you. In the world of Malchus, that's even more correct. It's even more accurate. Right? The Melech defines the economy for the people. There's a famous Gemara in Brachos, where the Gemara describes, midrashically, where it describes the whole conversation between the people and David, where the people come to David and he says, the people are impoverished, they have no money, they have no food, what do we do? And David says, well, let's shlach yadecha begedud, let's go out and let's fight the battles and let's bring the spoils of war, and we'll bring the spoils of war into the people. I think there's an element where the king is responsible for the well-being of the people. He can either provide them food, or in the case of Marie Antoinette, is it Marie Antoinette who said, let them eat cake? Right?
She
never really said that. But the message is that the king is responsible for the well-being of the people. They are eating from his lechem. Whose lechem does he eat from? The fundamental message to Shaul and to David is that ultimately, whereas the people are dependent upon the Melech, but the Melech's sustenance comes from his obedience and his loyalty to God. And the fact that they both begin their journey by a moment in which they encounter Lechem of the Mizbeach, and it's given to them, in Shaul's case, willingly, by divine decree, in David's case, desperately. But the message is, you are dependent upon God, not the other way around. And you have to be loyal to the message of God. Shaul's Achilles' heel
was that he wasn't like
that. Was that he never got that message.
Right. And David did.
And David's strength was that he always got that message. Exactly right.
Interesting.
But it starts with that moment, that conversation of the Lechem. So that's Achimelech ben Achituv, Achi Ikavod, ben Pinchas ben Eli Akoen Asher Bishilo.
The genes that filtered through.
Right. All right. Let's one more piece of this story, and then we'll read through the rest of the parak. We're not going to analyze the rest of the parak. I just want to be able to put the rest of the story out there. And then we'll pick that up next week. The last piece of this is Do'ega Adomi, Pasuk Tet. Sham ish me'avdei Sha'ul b'yom ahu ne'atzah lifnei Hashem. There, in that moment of that time, amongst this people was a servant of Sha'ul, who, what does ne'atzah lifnei Hashem mean? Phrase Netzar Lifnei Hashem.
Translation here says detained.
Detained. Stuck. Atzur.
Atzur.
Stop.
It means stop.
Atzur means stop. Yeah. What's an atzeret? Atzeret. As in atzeret of atzeret Hashem, right? The day of Yontif is called the. Right. It's a day in which you stop in order to serve God. Atzeret Hashem. It's a day stop from melacha. Atzeret Hashem lo tasel kol melacha. No, you have to stop what you're doing for your own melacha and serve God. That's why Yontif is often called an atzeret. Okay, so Netzar lifnei Hashem, he's bringing offerings, but he's detained, meaning he was part of this. Came people come and go in the Mishkan, but he got detained. He was stuck there. He had come to bring offerings, and happens to be. Ushmo Do'eg Adomi. Do'eg Ha'adomi. Abir Ha'ro'im Asher LeSha'ul. This, the great shepherd of Sha'ul. Meaning, some kind of leader, some kind of warrior, some kind of individual of stature in the kingdom of Sha'ul, happens to be there. His name is Do'eg Ha'adomi. What does Adomi mean?
Red.
Not Admoni. Oh. Adomi. Comes from the root. And here's the big debate amongst the Mefarshim. What is the source of the word Adomi?
From Edom.
It comes from the word Edom. Admoni would be red. David is Admoni. Doeg is Adomi. Adomi means from Edom. Which raises the question as to who this Do'eg is. So some suggest that he's actually not even Jewish. He's an Edomite, descendant of Edom. That would be problematic. Why would that be problematic? Even though it's easy to say, because it's very convenient to say. Because in the end, when Sha'ul issues the decree to everybody, to all of his servants, to go and execute the people of Nov, nobody wants to touch it. Do'eg Adomi is the first one to get up and say, I'll do it. So this guy is what we would typically call a Rosh Marusha. He's wicked to the core. Very convenient to say that he's an Edomite, descendant of Esav. But not quite. Why is that not quite so accurate? Because if he was an Edomite...
Would he be with Saul?
Right. He would be unlikely that he... Well, he could be in Saul's army, but it would be unlikely that he would be sitting in the Mishkan bringing offerings to Hashem. Right? Yeah. Ne'atzah lifnei Hashem in the Mishkan as an Edomite is... Maybe in the time of David and Shlomo, maybe in the time later on in history where you had other nations and alliances and allegiances with other nations, and Ki beti beit tefilah yikareh l'chol ha'amim, says Yeshayahu, that my house will be a house of prayer for all nations... Not at this point in time. Not at this point in history. We're too soon, too early. So we're clearly dealing with somebody who is an Edomite. Meaning he's got to be Jewish. So what does Edomi mean? So possibly, as some of the Mefarshim suggest, that he's a ger. He's an Edomite, but he's a ger. And so his roots are from Edom, but he himself is a ger. That's a possibility. I don't have any evidence to support either here or there. But it's also possible that the description of attached to a name, Regadomi, we'll see that with a few different personalities in Sefer Shmuel, is not about whether they're of Jewish origin or not Jewish origin, but rather where they come from, meaning what region of the country are they coming from. So the egg, the same way you would say Shaul was Ish Yemini, was from Shevet Binyamin, the egg was from the area of Edom. The area of Edom is essentially the area of Har Esav, is essentially the area of the Negev. So he comes from the south, or he comes from that area referred to as Adom, or Edom, and that would be essentially as part of Shaul's army, part of Shaul's operation, but he's there. And the fact that he's there means that for David, it's a warning light. Because more than the fact of the question of whether he's Jewish or not Jewish, the much bigger question is, where is his loyalty? Where is his loyalty? And his loyalty is clearly to Shaul. Abir haro'im asher l'shaul. And now David is faced with a challenge. He can't stay in Nov. Even if he had wanted to, he can't. The moment he recognizes Doeg there, and now he's got to move on. But if he's got to move on, he's dealt with the food. But if he's got to move on, he's got to be able to protect himself. When he ran from Shaul's service, he ran with nothing. He didn't run in a uniform. Mm-hmm. He's clearly not moving through the countryside in a military uniform of Shaul's army. So he has no weapon. So the moment he sees Doeg and he recognizes the fact that he can't stay there, now he has to worry about a weapon. And that's the segue to the next pasuk. Vayomer David l'Achimelech, ve'ein yesh patachet yadcha chanit acharef. Do you have any kind of weapon here? Any kind of tool of war? Now that would be an unlikely thing to have in the Mishkan. Because you're not allowed to use weapons in the Mishkan. You're not allowed to build with any kind of iron instrument any part of the Mishkan. Right? Certainly not the Mizbeach. So to have a weapon or to have a sword in the Mishkan is unlikely, but David is desperate. And it happens to be, Ki gam chabi v'gam kilay lo lakachti b'yadi ki yad v'ar ha-melech nachutz. Right? He's still carrying through the ruse that he's on a king's mission, then it was a quick mission, but now it's already getting weaker. Because you're on a secret mission for the king, why would you not take a weapon? But all right. Says, I don't have any weapon. Vayomer haKohen, Cherev Goliath haPlishti, asher hakita be'emek ha'ela, inehi luta basimla acharei ha'efod. Says, what do I have? I have one weapon. What is it?
The sword.
Sword of Goliath. It's a good weapon, but look where it is. It's wrapped and hidden under the ephod. Why is it wrapped and hidden?
They didn't want anybody to know it was there.
Right, because it's in secret on the one hand, and on the other hand, it is. What do you? When would you wrap something? You wrap it either to hide it or
dangerous.
It's sharp.
Right, or sharp, or yeah, to preserve it, to put it into a safe place, to put it into a special place. It's wrapped. It's in a place of honor. It's wrapped. It's under the ephod. Right? Why is it in a place of honor?
And I thought the weapons weren't supposed to be.
They're not supposed to be. So why is this one there? Why is this one there as a wrapped and placed in a special place?
It was used to kill Goliath, no?
And therefore?
Special.
Hashem's.
Right.
Hashem let it
it's
happen.
I think it's there for symbolism. It's there for a message. It's there for to be kind of almost like a monument to the great victory over the Plishtim, the great victory of Goliath. Over Goliath. It's there in the monument. If you remember, after David used it to chop off Goliath's head, they sent the sword, at the end of that parak, it says they sent the sword to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is anachronistic because Yerushalayim doesn't exist at that time, but the most likely interpretation is that they sent it to the Mikdash, they sent it to the Mishkan. So at that point it was sent to the Mishkan, here it is in the Mishkan.
It seems a little strange to have that in the Mishkan, I don't know.
It is strange, but considering the fact that they looked at it as a kind of a tribute to God's role, victory over Goliath, was one of the great moments in history. It was on display. It was in a museum piece. It was wrapped. It was...
Look what we did.
Right. Look what God did.
No,
right? It's in the Mishkan because it's look what God did.
Well, through God, yeah.
Right? That's the Chachma. Imotah kach lach. If you want it, it doesn't give it to him.
Oh, he doesn't. Okay,
it
doesn't make sense.
If you want it, take it. There's nothing better.
He's trying to protect them.
But notice that he doesn't want to.
He doesn't give it to him.
He doesn't want to give it to him. What does he say to David?
He tells him, take it.
If you want it, take it. It's yours anyway. David, on the other hand, says, "Vayomer David, ein kamoa tnenali. Nothing better. Give it to me." So you have this tension building between David and Achimelech. Who's going to give him the sword? You almost get the sense that Achimelech is kind of stepping back from his desire to help David. A little bit hesitant. Maybe he's looking over his shoulder. Maybe he's seeing Doeg watching this conversation. He doesn't want to be seen giving the sword to David. David, for his part, is not taking it. He's waiting for Achimelech to
give it to him.
And that tension's building. Where we go with that, we'll see. There's Hashem next week.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So, Eli was good, but his two sons,
Pincus
and
I'm not sure Eli is good either, but that's a separate.
So, well, that's part of the question. So then there's several generations.
So we're meeting tomorrow.
And yes. I'm just thinking, so well, by the time Hashem says he won't punish his son to the if he goes to the third or the fourth generation. So they changed. They did lawless things. They had relations with women. There was a thing with bread.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't here when we did the early chapters of Sefer Shmuel, right? It's a very interesting story. The Shmuel are posted if you want to listen to them. They're there. It's very interesting. It's a long answer to your question. But the story is not about Hophni and Pinchas. The story comes back to Eli. It comes back to corruption of priorities and of values, and it comes back to a whole corruption that's built into the mentality of the kahuna at that time. So it's much more... Chofni Pinchas are the symptom of it. I don't think they're the root cause of it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.